This is Wage World, where we talk to the most interesting people in the world on KABF 88.3, the voice of the people.
You want to see how the other half lives? You want to see how we get around? Why don't you come visit me on the east side of town?
This is Wade Breskin. You're listening to Wade's World, a Voice for the People program. Welcome to the east side of town so that we can talk about how the other half lives and what life is like here living in Wade's World, whether that's the east side of Little Rock, Greenville, or New Orleans, or on Acorn Radio in Nairobi, Bengaluru, Bristol, or Bombay. Points east and west, where we are either rebroadcast or live streamed at kabf.org, wamf.org, or acornradio.org. A podcast will be available of this show on those websites and at www.chieforganizer.org. You know the story on Wade's World. We talk to the most interesting people in the world. Today, we're talking to Kathleen Gasparian, an immigration lawyer based in New Orleans. Welcome to Wade's World, Kathleen.
Thank you so much for having us, Wade. It's good to be here this week.
Well, there's almost too much to talk about. I was just telling you before we went on the air that I loved the comment recently you made an email about. I said, well, you know, we're going to talk about immigration issues, and you said, yes, your clients sort of flee in panic every time they hear the word Trump open his mouth, so to speak. But we read about immigration all the time. The latest controversy seems to be, first it was an attempt to close all borders and then to, you know, alter the way green cards are issued. What in the world is going on now?
So the last week, you know, President Trump, I think it was on Monday, made a comment in a press conference that he was going to be closing the borders and stopping all immigration, and everybody panicked and scrambled, and it was like the next day before an official executive order was put out. And one of the crazy things that we've seen under this administration is how much attitude and policy can impact the way immigration happens without there actually ever being a change to the statutes or a change to the regulations. We really are seeing how much, you know, the world can shift without there being, you know, a congressional action on immigration. And so this is not the first time we've heard travel ban or ending immigration or changing the way immigration works from this administration. They made it very clear sort of the first few weeks in office. They, you know, in the first few months, they let out this very ambitious, at the time it seemed like, crazy ambitious plan of how to limit immigration, placing, you know, asylum courts outside of the United States and Mexico, changing the way business immigration works, ending the visa lottery, all these different things. And we've just sort of watched them sort of plod forward slowly, accomplishing all of them. And, of course, using changes in politics and things like COVID-19 and other events throughout the past few years to their advantage to further their agenda of very much anti-immigrant, nativist, nationalist, ending all immigration point of view. So, you know, one of the things I think that immigration lawyers have always sort of been saying is, he can't do that. Oh, wait, he's doing that. Now we have to go sue him so he will stop doing that. It's been an interesting ride. The most recent bans or policies, you know, what was touted in press conferences made it seem like there was going to be this very large blanket ban on all sorts of different things. And in the end, it's this very narrow application, which has a sign in relief, but then also tense as to what comes next. So, but the most recent one is, you know, it's sort of like to unravel what it really means for immigration, you have to understand how immigration works. And the truth of the matter is there's very few ways that people can come to the United States on their own. They have to have sort of pull bringing them to the United States, whether it's a family member or an employment opportunity or even a humanitarian concern. There's very few ways that you get to just come in and stay forever without having something that, you know, pulling you here, you know. And so people, you know, people come to the United States, whether we call it as a non-immigrant, a temporary period, temporary time, temporary purpose, or they come as an immigrant, which in the vernacular you call the green card or things like that. And so those applications sometimes happen abroad at a U.S. embassy, or they happen here in the U.S. At different immigration offices. And so what this most recent ban on immigration ended up doing is limiting very narrow parts of people making certain types of permanent resident applications. It's not the exact legal term, but it makes sense for us, you know, at U.S. embassies. And so it was touted as, oh, it's going to stop all these things. And in the end, what it really puts a pause on are these very small slices of immigration, individuals coming through the diversity lottery who are processing for the immigrant visas at U.S. embassies. And ultimately, employment-based applications at U.S. embassies, and most U.S.-based applications for permanent residence actually happen in the U.S. And then ultimately what will end up stopping permanent residents bringing their families, their children and their wives, or children and spouses into the U.S. through the embassy. So it stops like this incredibly small percentage of immigration, but in a way that, so it's not really protecting any, you know, the American workforce in any way, but it's much more achieving a different kind of policy, right, that we're going to stop, you know, a certain kind of person from coming to the United States. And I'll let you fill in the blank as to what the administration feels needs to be stopped to come into the United States.
So, Kathleen, if we understand you correctly, what you're really saying is part of this is just bluff and bullying and trying to chill the notion of people coming here without real policy or legal changes.
Well, yeah, I mean, I absolutely think that's true. You know, there's, when we talk about, we're working under the same immigration statute, essentially, 98%, that's been in place since 1996. And so we're not talking about statutory changes in the last 3 years. We're talking about an attitude and policies and priorities. And so you look at, you know, all the immigration issues you've seen over the past couple of years, travel bans, issues at the southern border, issues of detention, issues of, you know, arguments about whether or not temporary workers take away jobs from Americans and all those things. Those are the same issues that have been present in immigration for the last
forever.
20 years. But the attitude of how they are talked about in the media and by the administration is, it's a really aggressive. I would say it's like there's this one voice saying really, really loudly, no immigration. And then one little voice saying, all immigration, and there's no real room in the discourse for talking about what should immigration really look like? Is there a different way to do, to process, to deal with a refugee crisis, to deal with asylum claims, to deal with the needs of American businesses? Because all that nuance gets lost in, you know, very loud proclamations and dog whistles to a specific type of person and base, political base.
Well, and the dog whistles that are being wrapped now in COVID-19 are exactly what you're talking about, because poll was out today as we're speaking about how much people are concerned still about lifting the stay-at-home bans around the country, but they also are kind of for blocking immigration because they're, you know, listening to Trump try to claim that this is going to bring, you know, more disease into the country and threaten jobs, even though there's never been any proof over the last number of years that there's any decrease in American employment based on bringing immigrants. And in fact, Trump had to back up, as I read it, as I understand it, and I wonder if this is your take as well, because he was pushed by business. Oh my goodness, no, we still have to have immigrants come in to do the work. And so, oh, well, 24 hours later, I didn't mean closing all the border, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I think you know, the anti-immigrant rhetoric, right, is, I mean, you know, I'm a lawyer, I'm fascinated with language, the anti-immigrant rhetoric has the same language, same, you know, thing. You substitute yellow for China, or, you know, and
sure.
It's the same language that's been, you know, touted for, you know, since the late 1800s, you know, it's like, you know, the same arguments, oh, it's about disease, oh, it's about this other thing. When, and in terms of the use of foreign labor, I mean, like I said, the nuance of this discussion doesn't happen anymore, which is,
yes.
You know, why are U.S. employers needing foreign labor to do farm work, to do certain types of jobs? You know, why, you know, is there, when you have a percentage of the workforce that doesn't have paperwork and the jobs that they're filling, is it really impacting wages? Is it really impacting U.S., you know, or how is it impacting U.S. workers or things like that? Are these jobs that do provide for mobility or not? And that nuance is obviously nowhere in the discussions, but I absolutely agree that, you know, there is this sort of this blustery statement, and then everybody had to back up and go, no, wait, because if you're stopping all immigration, if we don't have, you know, there's not going to be agricultural workers, they're not going to be these workers, and there's, and it's not just at the brown collar, blue collar level, right? It's also at the neurosurgeon level, right? We talked about the needs for our hospital wages, especially here in Louisiana, and anything in the Delta, right? You know, Arkansas, you know, Louisiana, Mississippi, just these huge needs for physicians, for nurses, for researchers, for physical therapists, and you can't. So much of that is met by either foreign labor or individuals here studying from abroad and things like that. And you can't, so you can't just stop it. Right? It doesn't work that way. Even, I mean, you can have safeguards, obviously, in times of a pandemic that I think everybody would say maybe irrational, but it's not. You can't just
There's not a stick you can turn off. That's exactly
right.
What.
There's too much in our economy that's dependent. And then we're also talking about families. We're talking about husbands and wives and kids. And, you know, I don't think it's really an all or nothing game, even though that is absolutely, I think, part of the rhetoric coming out of this administration.
We're talking to Kathleen Gasparian, an immigration lawyer based in New Orleans. Since we're talking about Louisiana, we have an inordinate number of detention centers in Louisiana, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. We are, I think we're number two. These numbers are fluctuate, and they're not always up to date in terms of what, you know, as far as, you know, it's hard to stay up with the most up-to-date DHS numbers, but we're talking about 10,000 beds with rapidly rising numbers. It may be at, like, could be as 15 to 18. I know at one point there was a goal to get it to 20,000 beds in Louisiana.
So whether we're first or second or whatever, we've got way too many beds in detention. Do y'all have clients in some of these detention centers? What is it like up there?
So we, just sort of like as a matter of course with our practice, we do a really limited amount of detention work right now because it's hard. And I can do a shout out to all of the lawyers who log in the detention centers every day, because the difficulty of representing detained individuals. So I think the first great big myth is we have this idea as Americans, like, oh, well, if you're in court and you're being tried with something, you know, charged with something, you get a lawyer, and that's not true in immigration. So any foreign national who's in immigration proceedings, trying, you know, where the government's saying you don't belong here, you need to be removed, doesn't get an attorney automatically. There's no assigned counsel. It's if the foreign national would like an attorney and can pay for an attorney and can find an attorney, then they, you know, there's a right to counsel in proceedings. But it's the one you choose and the one you pay. And the reality of the detention centers in Louisiana is they're far away from cities. You know, they're 3 hours away from New Orleans, 4 hours away. They're not close to a major airport, each detention center has separate rules for how an attorney communicates with their client, and maybe you don't get to communicate, or maybe you don't get to meet them in person, and maybe the hearing before the judge is done on video, or and it's these incredibly there's all sorts of obstacles and hoops for representation. And then you're also in a court system that is designed to move as quickly as possible to flip these cases, to resolve these cases more likely than not with an order of deportation. The detained denial rate is 85-90% across the board. When you add it all up. And so what we know is that there's, 10,000 bodies, let's say, in detention in Louisiana. 70% of those are moving through detention in like a month's time. They're being brought into Louisiana from all over the country right now, predominantly from the southern border, flipping through proceedings in 30 days, and then being removed from the United States, ultimately. So you're talking about this really fast turnover. The majority of individuals being detained in Louisiana under DHS are not Louisiana residents. I mean, they're not people from our communities necessarily, though there is a good portion of that as well. I mean, there's a percentage of that as well. Also, not everybody in detention has a right to go in front of a judge, and it becomes, in so many ways, sort of this invisible machine. You don't know where the centers are. If you're driving down the highway, if you don't know it's there, you're not going to see it, and it's all happening sort of invisibly. There's an airport in Alexandria, Louisiana, and anybody who's from Central Louisiana, Ellic. It's not a big town. It used to have an air base there, but it's an international airport because of ICE Air, so Immigration and Customs Enforcement Air, which is almost daily sending flights of people back to the countries where that they may be nationals or citizens of. So it's this incredible machine, and in so many ways, we don't talk about the nuances of this discussion, which is, these are detention centers that, provide jobs for local communities, but who are the people that we're detaining? Right now, we don't have facilities for kids. We have, but we do have lots of adults, and male and both female. And so, the question about is it right, right? We know that individuals who are not detained are more likely to find access to counsel, so they're more likely to succeed in their case. There's also the difficulty of preparing a case for trial in detention, obtaining evidence, preparing witnesses, things like that. And then when you match it with a really distant, hard to get to place, it can really become an insurmountable problem. And ICE, DHS will say, oh, we put people in Louisiana because of money, but there's also the realities of the access to counsel issues that I'm sure are a nice added bonus for them.
Well, and everything we read about the problems on the southern border, where they were pushing people into Tijuana, into Matamoros, across the border, mm-hmm. so that they had no access to counsel, and then had to fight, somehow figure out a way to get back. I mean, tens of thousands of people were in this situation.
Absolutely.
So here's a lot of people are curious still of what happened to the Dreamers. I mean, family unification and the problem of children who were basically raised in the U.S. Who didn't decide that they were going to come here legally or illegally, just mm-hmm. happened to, wake up at 4 years old, 5 years old, seven, whatever, and have been residents and participants of the U.S. society for all these years. What's their status now? It's sort of been in limbo, and it's hard to follow for a lot of our listeners. Do you all follow any of this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, so DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, is sort of, we're all waiting for you know, the Supreme Court to maybe give us some indication of where DACA is going to go. So, you know, DACA was, you know, something that came out of the Obama administration because there was no congressional movement on statutory changes. And so it is just as much an executive order and executive policy as many of the things that Trump is doing. So if DACA is coming out of executive policy, and it was formalized in regulations and all those other things, you know, the issue we have now is, you know, how can the successor unwind it and how and all those different things. So everybody's sort of in limbo. We're waiting to hear. We know that, I think the estimate, you know, there's a couple thousand kids in Louisiana on, well, they're not kids anymore, I guess, you know, so it's now been
right.
Young adults most of the time, you know, in college or after, in these, doing great things for our community. And yeah, they are in these limbo states where, you know, if it ends, there will be consequences for them. You know, you have to assume if it happens, you know, in the near future, that it's very likely going to include removal proceedings, deportation, things like that.
But a decision isn't necessarily scheduled by the court, Supreme Court, until after the election,
right?
Is it? So
I don't know exactly when we're anticipating there being a decision.
I know I haven't read anything recently about
an
expectation
either.
Of one coming, and that makes you believe that as political as the court is now, that there may be enough of a split that they're waiting. But so you've got hundreds of thousands of people across the country. I mean, you're right, we may not have huge numbers in Louisiana, but this has been affecting people for a long time.
Absolutely.
But part of the issue is also just family unification, which has long been a solid part of the immigration, but it's also deteriorating, isn't it, Kathleen?
I would say so. I mean, there are these really draconian consequences in the immigration statute. You know, things like if you have entered the United States without permission, you know, and you've been here without permission, then we may not be able to finish your paperwork here. You have to leave. And when you leave, you have to sit out for 10 years. And for many people, there's no way around that punishment of sitting outside the United States for 10 years. And these are, you know, these are parents of citizens of the United States, spouses of citizens of the United States, kids. You know, and so there's these bars in the law it's not within an immigration judge's power to circumvent, you know, to get around these obstacles within the law. So, or a consular official. And so there's these big obstacles sometimes to keeping families together, or to, you know, having families all in the same place at the same time. The most recent ban last week is absolutely impacts this as well, you know, by saying, you know, people who have been waiting to join their permanent resident spouse in the United States for 2 years, well, now we're not even going to let you come at all, right? And we're not even going to do anything on your case for the next 60 days. And that could be longer. So these separations continue. One of the overarching sentiments in the Immigration Nationality Act is absolutely about family unity. And that seems to get lost, I think, in a lot of the policy shuffles.
But these courts are overwhelmed, from what I understand. The delays are huge. You've had immigration judges, clamoring that they, you know, need to double the workforce or whatever, that the caseload is amazing. I don't know if this is something that you and Leah Spivey run into, but do you all have long delays waiting for cases to come up before an immigration judge?
Absolutely. You know, Leah and I are both litigators. We both handle removal cases all the time. And so a couple, I think, facts that are important to understand about immigration court. So the first, you know, we call it a court, and we call the decision maker judges, but it is not a court and a judge in the way that you think about federal court or the way you think about what you see on TV, right? That the an immigration judge is actually an employee of the Department of Justice. So they fall under the executive branch. You know, going back to your three parts of the government, they are not within the judicial branch of the government, which means they're employees of the Attorney General. And so there's many ways in which the Attorney General can direct how the employees of the Department of Justice act, they can set goals and standards for production for employees because they are lawyers within DOJ and not independent judges. So as lawyers, I'm always advocating for what's called an Article I immigration court, so moving immigration judges over into the judicial branch. A pretty esoteric legal topic that I won't go too deep in, but the understanding that these are judges with, you know, they're the people making the decisions are reporting to the AG, while ICE, the enforcement, DHS, has this incredibly huge budget to arrest, detain, and prosecute. For a long time, EOIR, the agency dealing with, heading immigration courts, is a starved, anemic branch because it was. And so they just don't have the capacity to keep up with the prosecution numbers. And that has been true for a really long time. That's not just this administration, that's previous administrations. And so there's what happens is an individual comes in front of an immigration judge, maybe they don't win their case, so they have an order of removal, but there's, for a long time, they're not in custody, right? And so then you have the problem of, you have a lot of people who've went in front of the judge but now have an order, but now their world has changed in some way, so maybe they're trying to come back and get a new case in front of the judge. And then you just have this sort of steady influx of enforcement. And so the numbers coming in to the immigration court far exceed capacity. And so it is not uncommon to be waiting. You may appear in front of an immigration judge today, but it may be 3, 4, 5 years before you get a trial on your case. And those are 3, 4, 5 years where you may or may not have permission to work. You may be waiting for, to win your case so that you can bring your family in. The amount of time, it's this really weird dichotomy. So in open, non-detained court, it may take years to go through an immigration case, or in a detained setting, they're under this really fast track. And so where you need time, they're trying to resolve cases in 30 days. But we've seen a lot of real, challenges in immigration court. The Attorney General has limited the power of immigration judges to continue cases, to what we call administratively closed cases, take cases off the docket, to let cases, oftentimes somebody in removal proceedings is waiting for another branch to do something. And so all of those sort of the little discretion an immigration judge had has been slowly winnowed away over the last 2 years. And
there's no good news we're hearing about immigration reports. We've been talking to Kathleen Gasparin, who's one of an immigration lawyer based in New Orleans. Kathleen, if people want to continue this conversation and have questions for you or Leah Spivey, your partner, how can they get a hold of you?
So obviously COVID-19, we don't do in-person appointments right now, but we are always available for telephone calls or web-based video chats. Our phone number is 504-262-9878. Our website is GS, Gasparin Spivey, Immigration Law, so GS Immigration Law. We keep up a pretty robust blog. If you didn't realize from this conversation, I have some rants I love to go down and some soapbox, I love my soapbox sometimes.
When the podcast comes out, we can put it there as well. So fantastic. That's, you hear
absolutely.
That? You hear the website, and it sounds like this is a good place where anybody who wants to know more about this can get advice. Thank you, Kathleen Gasparin. This has been Wade's World for another week, the world where the other half lives, where we talk about things you've never heard, and as Lucinda Williams sang, things you've never seen and will never forget. Wade's World is underwritten by the Darrow Foundation, a progressive force enabling change, based in Little Rock, Arkansas, and as the song goes, we say it loud, we say it on the air, we say it on the radio. Until next week, when we'll have another guest, this is Wade Rafty from Wade's World. Thank you.